Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. You know, if you follow me on social media, I'm sorry if you do, it's useless, you will probably hear sooner or later about how much I hate Bucatini. I will not be taking questions on this matter at this time. Please refer to this episode from last year. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Hey, you know how people are always like coming up to you and telling you how you need to build your personal brand? But now that doesn't happen to you? Like you hang out with regular human beings who are actually fun at parties? Anyway, I am here today to build my personal brand. Francis Lam, Bucatini hater number one. That's right. I mean, look, I love pasta. I love it, love it, love it. Every pasta shape is righteous and beautiful and deserves its place on this good earth, except for Bucatini, which is a sick joke played on people who need to eat food. I mean, look, it's like this long, thick spaghetti with a hole running through it. It's like trying to twirl a garden hose on your fork, and everyone loves to talk about, ooh, but all the sauce gets in the middle, all the sauce gets in the hole. What good does that do you if you can't actually eat it? Because look, you can't twirl it, you can't slurp it. It's like a straw. You suck on a straw and what happens? Nothing happens. The straw doesn't go anywhere. That's the point of a straw. Why are you trying to tell me that is a good shape for pasta? Anyway. A few years ago, Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast, organized an evening event in a real live performance space in New York City. And the main attraction, well, actually the only attraction because we couldn't afford to, you know, hire an opening act, was that I would come and debate the merits of various pasta shapes with an expert. The chef and host of the terrific, legendary radio show Good Food, Evan Kleinman. Well, I don't want to spoil anything, but it was a hard-fought intellectual battle. Evan is extremely knowledgeable about cuisine. She studied Italian food. She ran a legendary Italian restaurant in LA for over 20 years. And I hate long pasta with holes in it. So there, in the New York City night, in front of an opinionated live audience, we went at it, starting with spaghetti.
So, right off the bat, spaghetti. It sucks. Am I right, Francis?
No. I'm sorry, I'm not Francis.
All right, Evan, go on. Defend spaghetti.
Okay, first of all, spaghetti is the ur pasta. It is the beginning of all pasta. And it's the beginning of handmade pasta and the beginning of industrialized pasta. But more than that, it's how every child becomes indoctrinated into the beauty of eating. When they suck up that first little strand, when they're a little kid and they realize that they can do that by pursing their lips and sucking in, that's it. They're like gone for the rest of their lives.
Francis?
I'm with Evan on this one. I think spaghetti, I mean, I was going to go, I mean, it's a Sporkful. It's for eaters, not for foodies.
Right.
Saying spaghetti sucks because it doesn't have the right surface area and the right, like, amount of contact with your teeth is a very foodie approach, Dan. I feel like for eaters, you say exactly what Evan said, which is, what is the first pasta you ever ate? What is the thing that made you fall in love with pasta? And damn, if it's not spaghetti, I don't know where you grew up.
Yeah, and like spaghetti night. Spaghetti is that thing that crossed over and became American.
I will grant you that spaghetti is significant. It is important in pasta history, and it has a lot of romanticism, and it has a lot of sentimental attachments to it. But I'm just saying, right now, here and now, as we sit here as adults who have so many pasta shapes to choose from, tell me one thing that spaghetti does better than any other pasta shape.
It makes me feel like a child. Now that I'm old and wizened and want to die.
You said that with such vulnerability. I don't know. I kind of feel like this veers over into Team Bucatini territory, but I feel like spaghetti, everything is great with spaghetti, but it would be better with a thicker round noodle.
Right. So you're saying that there's, like, to me, any top echelon pasta shape.
Top echelon?
Yeah.
Anything they have status?
Sure. If it's going to be in the top echelon, there must be at least one thing that it can do that no other pasta shape can do as well.
Well, what spaghetti can do that no other pasta shape can do as well is be affordable.
Ooh. Oh. I don't know why she said that. But
aren't they all the same price now in the supermarket?
and accessible. Okay, it's okay. The most accessible.
I should consult with my wife. She always wanted to be on, what's the, Supermarket Sweeps, or Price is Right, thank you. Like, she was always the one who would know exactly the price of the carton of milk, you know. Like, she would know. It's $1.99 for every box, right?
Not if you're getting imported Italian pasta.
89 cents on sale, she says.
Oh, there you go.
All right.
Where do you live in New York City? And where do you shop?
That's why I moved out to the country, Francis. We don't live in the city anymore.
Yeah, that shiz is $7.99 where I am.
So before we get into more pasta-shaped debates, I want to allow our listeners to get to know you guys a little bit more and to understand your particular connections to pasta. Evan, tell me about a particular formative pasta dish in your life.
Well, aside from spaghetti... I would say it was when I was in my early 20s, maybe barely 20, and I was on my third trip to Italy, and I was hanging out with some friends in San Remo, and I was on the beach, and I got hungry, and I was with a friend of mine who's Italian, and he said, oh, let's go get something to eat, and so I'm looking for the frozen banana stand, being from Los Angeles. And he said, no, let's go have a nice plate of spaghetti alla vongole. And I'm like, they have that here at the beach? And so we go up to a thatched roof restaurant where everybody's sitting in the restaurant in their bathing suits. And I was served this bowl of linguine alla vongole. And it was, which is linguine with clams, with garlic, wine, parsley, lemon juice. And that was just it for me.
And what do you mean? Like, why was that so
significant? It blew my mind. Well, the whole experience was this coming together of high food craft that was obviously geared to a culture, attached to a culture, embedded in the sensuality of summer in Italy at the beach. So it was like a seamless whole, a beautiful little bubble that just crashed over my, Los Angeles, raised in the 60s, not anything like that at all.
Right. How is your life different today because of that bowl of pasta?
I went home and I had to figure out how to make it. And so, I had always cooked. I was one of those latchkey kids who cooked growing up. But when I started traveling to Europe and tasting things and then coming home and wanted to reproduce them, it sort of put me in a different place, a different level of obsession, and also an understanding of where my heart really lay, even though I went on to get a BA in Italian literature and film and an MBA. Yeah. And then they ended up having a restaurant, right?
A short dalliance with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Did you put that MBA to good use?
Oh, well, my restaurant's closed.
Francis, tell us about a formative pasta dish in your life.
You know what's crazy is my answer is also linguine alla vongole.
I love this so much.
Wow.
A, because it's awesome. But B, more importantly, because I grew up the child of Chinese immigrants in suburban New Jersey. And one cheer for suburban New Jersey. Exactly. Woo! One whoop. a mere 5 miles from here as the crow flies, and there's one whoop for suburban New Jersey. But I grew up, you know, one of two Asian kids in my elementary school. I always felt weird. I always felt different. I didn't really belong. And then my parents worked in Chinatown here in New York City, which is the neighborhood right over from Little Italy. And I would come out to their work. Like, we didn't have...
childcare?
Yes. Or things to do as a child. So, like, when it was summertime, like, what are you going to do today? Mommy, can I come to work with you? And literally sit in your workplace for 10 straight hours and not do any damn thing. Yeah, well, that sounds great. I'm going to do that. But the highlight was that we would go out to lunch, and sometimes we would go to Little Italy. And when we went to Little Italy, if we were feeling high on the hog, we would go to a place called Il Cortile, which means the courtyard. And there was this beautiful courtyard. And it was this sort of Italianate, you know, it was like really quite beautiful. And there was an indoor courtyard and a skylight, and it felt like you were in some al fresco place. I didn't know those words. I'd never been to Italy. I'd never seen pictures of Italy, but felt like I was somewhere else, you know, somewhere that was not my Chinese immigrant household in suburban New Jersey. And the food came out, and my parents would, you know, order for me. And we got linguine alla vongole every single time because it was noodles and seafood, which is food we understood as Chinese people, but white people ate it. So when I would eat linguine alla vongole, or as my mom called it, linguine with white clam sauce, I felt like maybe I can belong.
And how did those experiences eating in that restaurant, how is your life different today because of those experiences?
I became a white person. It's great. You can see the stuff I can do now.
Yeah. All right, so clearly we've established that both of you guys have had very moving experiences, including Francis's extraordinary transformation.
Why are you laughing? Wait.
That is Evan Kleiman, host of Good Food, at an event with me put together by Dan Pashman called the Bucatini Dialogues. And after this break, we'll be back with Dan because after that night, he went on to invent his very own pasta shape. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed up breakfast burrito to a late night PB&J. They even have monthly small batch drops of indulgent treats like 2 gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1 gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. So here's a question. What makes a great pasta shape? Does it have to be long and thin? Does it have to be short and chunky? Does it have to go with a certain kind of sauce? How should it feel when you're chewing it? Well, after Dan Pashman from the Sporkful podcast put together that debate you just heard about pasta shapes between me and Evan Kleiman, who hosts Good Food, he set out to invent and manufacture his very own pasta shape. It's been a little while. It's been years, in fact. But I had some the other day. Boy, done good. Dan Pashman, welcome to The Splendid Table.
Thanks, Francis. Good to be here.
We got together like 3 years ago now. I'm like actually counting the days to debate pasta shapes. And back then, I remember you said, hey, this is great. I'm going to go out and invent a new pasta shape. So what's taken so long, man? This is like the project of a lifetime.
I feel like I ran into you like a year and a half or 2 years ago, and I was like, the pasta shape's still a work in progress. And you were just like shaking your head. You didn't say it, but the look on your face was like, this guy, this is not going to happen.
I never doubted. I was just disappointed.
I appreciate it. You would not have been alone if you did doubt. But it turned out that inventing a new pasta shape is much harder than I thought it would be. You know, I expected that it would be hard to come up with a really great idea for a shape, but mm-hmm. I didn't think it would be that hard to get it made. Part of my mission, it's not just to invent the shape, it's to get it made and to sell it. That turned out to be the hard part. You know, anyone can like 3D print one piece of a shape, but I wanted this to be something real that people could participate in. That's where it got complicated.
Okay, so what were you trying to maximize for when you were engineering a new pasta shape?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think, look, I love pasta. You put any plate of pasta in front of me, I'll be happy to eat it. But I do think that a lot of the classic shapes have something faulty about them. You know,
God, you just said that.
I have three criteria, Francis, by which I judge all pasta shapes. Number one, forkability. How easy is it to get it on the fork and keep it there?
Okay.
Number two, sauceability. How readily does sauce adhere to the shape? And number three, and I think most important of all, tooth sink ability. How satisfying is it to sink your teeth into it? And there's a lot of pasta shapes out there that are very good at one or two of those, but very few that nail all three. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I did was just eating a whole bunch of pasta shapes, and even some I had eaten before, and be very methodical, cataloging attributes and trying to narrow the field. And I, from those tests, I determined that one shape that I really love above almost any other is Mafalda, also known as Mafaldina. It's a long, flat noodle like a fettuccine, but with ruffles down the edges. I mean, I'm sure you mm-hmm. know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like a lasagna, but narrow enough to twirl on your fork.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to build from there. And then I get into bucatini, which I was with you, Francis. I was with you. Everyone says the sauce gets in the hole in the bucatini, and I agree with you. It does not. I think, you know, I was like, bucatini is overrated. But then I had a revelation.
Okay.
And I did a total 180 on bucatini because I realized that what makes it great is not about the sauce getting into the straw-shaped tube. Uh-huh. What makes it great is that because it's a narrower tube than just about any other tube pasta, it's springy.
Yeah, okay.
It's texture that makes bucatini great. Any fat tube, like a rigatoni or a penne, you bite into it and it goes flat. Mm-hmm. Bucatini springs back, and I wanted to try to get that springiness. So I started trying to say, how can I combine Mafalda and bucatini and some other flourishes? And that was the direction I started going in the shape. But then it turns out that you can't get a tube and ruffles in the same shape. That's when the rubber met the road. I had to actually manufacture, and that first concept was physically impossible.
It was like an M.C. Escher drawing. It's like, it looks good on paper.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, like, so most pastas are extruded through a die, D-I-E. Like, it's like the mold. Okay. You know, everyone remembers the Play-Doh factory. You push the Play-Doh through the star-shaped circle and a star comes out the other side. Like, that's how pasta's
made. I literally
had
to fix my daughter's yesterday. But yeah.
Okay. So, you know, when the dough is passing through that die and the shape is being made, I learned the hard way that you can't make a tube and ruffles simultaneously. Because the movement required to create the ruffles crushes the tube.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. I'm excited to talk with you about this, Francis, because I feel like you and I can really nerd out on this. I never would have guessed how ruffles are actually made in pasta. So the hole in the die, picture just like a flat horizontal line with a circle at each end of the line. And those circles are what make the ruffles. And I would have thought the ruffles were made by just like inside the die as the dough moves through, there's a thing that's shaped like a ruffle.
Yeah.
Like a squiggly line, and that makes a ruffle. Yeah. Not so. The ruffle parts of the hole are bigger so that the dough flows faster through those holes, and then the hole in the dye is narrower in other parts so that the dough goes slower. So by having the dough in parts of the shape moving faster through the dye than others, it backs up against itself and buckles.
It literally ruffles itself. It like so crunches it, itself.
It's literally right. It's continuously crashing into itself and backing up, crashing, buckling, and each time it buckles, it forms a ruffle.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Wow, like you and me, like we're like giggling, laughing about it.
I know.
Everyone listening is like, what? What? Who cares? Like, how could you possibly care?
Yeah.
Okay, so now you have your shape. You have, and I actually, full disclosure, you very graciously sent me a sample of it. It is delicious.
Thank you.
Very unusual shape. It is a half tube with ruffles and these like cool little like square squigglies at the end that increase the tooth sinkability, I think.
Yeah. One of the key things we did that made it possible to get a half tube, not a full tube, but a half tube and ruffles together is we moved the ruffles onto one side so that rather than sticking out of the edges of the main strip, they're both sticking out of one side. And that was like the key that unlocked the combination of a tube and a ruffle element.
Wow, this guy's still really talking about his ruffles. Okay, so here's the last question, right? There are, as I understand it, literally over 400, like, officially sanctioned, recognized pasta shapes, right? Over 400. And that's not including, you know, the adult novelty shapes or, the, you know, like the mac and cheese that's shaped like a bunny or whatever.
Right.
How did you figure out that what you wanted didn't already exist?
Well, first I consulted with Maureen Fant, who translated the Encyclopedia of Pasta, which for our purposes is basically the Bible on this subject. She said this doesn't exist. She's never seen it. And I also consulted with the guy who designed the dye for my pasta shape, who is the only, as far as I can tell, the only pasta dye designer working in America today. And he comes from like four generations of pasta dye designers. He said he's never seen it. So as far as I can tell...
You're mad, Daniel. You're mad.
As far as I can tell, this is the only shape like it.
Okay, and what do you like to sauce your shape with?
Well, this is an area where I may ruffle some feathers, Francis. To me, the whole idea that like to every shape there is a sauce and to every sauce there is a shape, I think is more tied up in kind of folklore and tradition than in reality. I think that a truly great pasta shape, like the one I have tried to create, should be really great with like 75 or 80% of the sauces out there. I mean, no shape will be great with every conceivable sauce. But like a really great shape should go with a wide range of different sauces. So I think really anything thick or anything with bits and pieces, those parts will nuzzle into the part of the shape I call the sauce trough. And you got the ruffles, those pick up more liquidy sauce. So I think it's very sauceable with a lot of different sauces.
Right on. I am totally with you on the sauce and shape thing. Congratulations to you and your cascatelli. I'm super excited for you.
Thank you, Francis. Thank you for being a part of it. And, you know, people took especially a lot of delight in hearing you drop some profanity with regard to your opinions about Bucatini in episode one of our series. So if you want to hear that side of Francis, check it out.
the non-public radio side, Francis After Dark.
Right.
All right, brother, take care of yourself. Congratulations on recognizing the 401st pasta shape.
My pleasure. Thanks, Francis. I appreciate it.
That is Dan Pashman, host of The Sporkful and the creator of Cascatelli, coming to a pasta bowl near you. You can catch the story of his entire 3-year quest to invent that pasta shape on his podcast, The Sporkful. So with all the talk about pasta shapes today, I figured you're going to want to eat some tonight. I mean, I want to eat pasta every night, so it's probably not a hard call. And for some tips on how to make your pasta better than ever, we brought in an expert, Douglas Williams. He is the chef and owner of Mita Restaurant in Boston, and he is more obsessed with pasta than probably anyone you know. Chef Douglas Williams, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So here's something I'm fascinated by, because you grew up in a restaurant family. Both your parents, I believe, worked in the restaurant industry. And you know, your training took you all around the world. You worked in French haute cuisine. You cooked in Thailand for a while. How did you decide that when you finally had the opportunity to create your own restaurant, to really like put forth like the thing you want to put in the world, how'd you decide to have such a focus on pasta?
I think after I came back from France, you know, I was looking for what I needed to do, how I needed to do it. You know, timing is not always as you imagine it. You know, you imagine coming back and finding the money, finding a partner, doing all these things, and, you know, finding a space. But it, sometimes it just doesn't work as fast, and there's obviously life things going on as well. But when I did get back, I stopped at my a good friend's restaurant called Julia, Mike Pagliarini.
I love that place.
And yeah, and he, you know, Nate obviously always needs some good hands, and he knew my work ethic and I knew his for sure. And, you know, I knew he was doing pasta. He was doing great work. You know, always had a busy restaurant. I was like, well, that's the place to go to at least figure out what I need to do next. Mm-hmm. And I would come in and he would show me, you know, whatever I needed to see, making his pappardelle or any of his pasta. And I just really fell in love with that process. And it's about teaching. You know, that was something that I promised myself, that if I did get into a profession or any sort of entrepreneurial venture or whatever it is, it has to involve teaching in some sense. And, you know, pasta just seemed like that thing that made sense in order to do as a concept. You know, it's really relatable. Obviously, Italian cuisine is wildly popular all across the board, no matter where you are in the world. So it seemed like the right way to go. And I also just love it. I love cooking. I love teaching. I love making. I love eating it. even in fresh restaurants, even the most, you know, highest end cuisine I've ever worked, we still had tortellini on the menu. So it definitely crosses all barriers when it comes to cuisine. So it seemed like the right choice.
Yeah, I love that. I love that idea of how you said pasta makes it easy to teach, or it's great to teach, or it's more about, it sounds like it's more about this commitment to the idea of teaching and pasta as a vehicle for that. Tell me more about that. Like, why, what is it about pasta in particular that makes you feel that way?
You know, pasta has something uniquely, you know, particular about its development. As you're making it in front of you, it transforms in front of you, in your hands, right when you think it's not going to, you know, come together or do what it needs to do. It surprises you, and that's based off of, you know, sometimes the heat of your hand, how strong you are. I mean, everything is variable when it comes to pasta. No recipe is exact in every way, but, you know, something similar to what I was told when I was first coming up. I was frustrated. I was doing some recipe and it wasn't, you know, quite working out, and I was trying to make it work for that moment. The chef was away, and one of the sous chefs came over to me and said, you know, just got to think about it like this next time you get frustrated. A recipe, you know, is a guide, not God. And when you think of it in those terms, you know, you kind of relax yourself, your shoulders are loosened, you know, you just kind of just like, it's just food, right? It's made to figure out. It's made to be, you know, in a sense frustrating, because all it is just things that grow from the ground plus heat. And you do those things together and there's a lot of variability there. So if you just kind of take a step back, it kind of sets you on a path that leads to a lot of possibilities.
Yeah, I love the idea. And so bigger picture, outside of the realm of, you know, your restaurant, like, I feel like cooking pasta, like you were talking a lot, I think, about making pasta and working with the dough and seeing how the dough is reacting to your hands and all that stuff. But I also feel like just the simple act of cooking pasta has really taken a turn in our country in the last 10, 20 years or something. Like, I remember when pasta experts were still trying to fight the fight of telling people to, you know, you actually have to salt the water before you cook it. Or, you know, no, don't put oil in the water. I remember when I was a kid, my mom made spaghetti, she put oil in the water. And then, you know, then people were saying, no, you don't do that because that makes the sauce slip off, not stick to it, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like we've advanced as a society as a whole. We've learned those lessons, at least, those basic things.
Right.
What would you say are, like, if you were just talking to a home cook, what would you say are, like, the two or three biggest things you'd say to them on how to make better pasta?
You know, so as far as cooking better pasta, you know, you want to just try to just take a step back and realize what is going on, right? You have the water, you have this pasta, which is either fresh or dry. It doesn't really matter which one you use. There's some steps after you cook it that really matter the most. And as well as during. So let's just go over a few of those. So, you know, you have the salted water. Let's just start by saying salted water as opposed to just boiling water, because then you just assume that you need to salt it, right? Just say salted water and boiling, obviously. You toss the pasta in. Once you toss that pasta in, all that pasta is trying to do is absorb the water. That's all. That's all you're trying to do is make it absorb without sticking together. And that is easy to do within the first 10 seconds. Once you add that pasta, whether it be dry or fresh, you agitate it. You agitate it with a tong or a tweezer or a fork, whatever you may have, not your hand, obviously. But you want to, and don't try to shake the pot. That would also be catastrophic. But just do something to essentially get a separation. Yeah. So, you know, you add in your pasta. First 10 seconds, you want to agitate it. Essentially, as pasta starts to absorb, it has a sort of a gumminess, right? You mix water and flour together, it's going to have that muddy gumminess to it. And that's essentially with that very outer coating. And that stickiness lasts for about 20 seconds. And if it's touching another piece of pasta, it will stick to that other piece of pasta because they're both gluey. And as it starts to really hydrate and become cooked, those proteins, you know, seal, and you will end up with this glob of pasta and somehow a new pasta shape called stuck together spaghetti, which is interesting, but not that fun. So once you get past that point, then you are in the home stretch of, okay, I only have a few more minutes to just not mess this up and get it to the right texture, right? So we want to get it to al dente. So we basically want to undercook the pasta to the right amount. So now when we think of al dente, we think we're having a little toothiness, a little bit of bite. Not everyone is very well versed on what that is actually supposed to be. And yes, I can give you a time. It can be 6 minutes or 3 minutes or 1 minute or 10 minutes, but it's going to come to you tasting it. You know, I would say at every minute, taste a piece of pasta and just taste them as they go and see how each minute goes. And I know that seems like very precious and not fun, but once you do it, you can kind of move on.
Yeah, you know what you're aiming for.
Yeah, exactly. So once the pasta is about ready and it feels a little toothy, that's when you want to take it out, right? You want to take it out, put it on a sheet tray, hit it with a little bit of olive oil, maybe a teaspoon, just to drizzle it over, give it a little toss with your fingers or a spoon. And let that be for a second. Just let that out to the side. As long as they're not piled up hugely on top of each other, they'll be fine. Now you want to start your sauce. So whatever sauce you're making, and this is the biggest difference, this part that I'm going to say now, is dilution. This is the largest separation between home-cooked pasta and restaurant-quality pasta. Mm. And a lot of home cooks know nothing about this process. Dilution is a magical thing. So basically, once your pasta is cooked on the sheet tray, off to the side, just looking at you, waiting for it to be used, you now have this sauce, right? Whether it be a bought sauce, whether you made it, you have that finished sauce. Now we're going to add water to it. So what you want to do is actually put that other big pot to the side with the sauce in it, add, you know, say 4 ounces of sauce per person. So 8 ounces of sauce in a saute pan, and you take 8 ounces of pasta water that you just cooked that pasta in, you add it to that saute pan. Now you bring that to a boil. And then you add your pasta to that saute pan, and then you have this magic, which is dilution. What the dilution does is allows this pasta that you just cooked to finish cooking to perfect al dente, because remember, it's a little undercooked than you want it. You add this slightly undercooked pasta to this saute pan. It's boiling. You start to notice that the pasta starts to turn red or whatever color that the sauce is, because the noodle is now literally absorbing the sauce that you're boiling it in. And it is finishing the cooking process. So you have this sheen that comes over this pasta, right? That sheen when you sit down at a restaurant and this pasta has like this, like, where did they get this hairspray to put on this pasta to make it so shiny and emulsified? And it just has this look like it's alive, right? You have to do this dilution process in order to cook that restaurant quality pasta. And that, I know it long-winded as it is, but that is one of the keys. And then you just have to do it 1,000 times and then you become really good at it.
So like it sounds like the key obviously is, you know, salting the water, it's agitating the pasta right when it goes in, but tasting it as you go along, pulling it out right when it's just before you think it's actually going to be delicious.
Right before you think it's al dente. So before.
Yeah, yeah. And then you kind of let it lie.
Yes.
Let it lie on a sheet tray so it's
so it's cooling down. And then this is the key part, because, you know, I've known for years you're supposed to finish cooking the pasta in the sauce. But, you know, when people have always said, oh, add a little splash of the pasta water to the sauce. And I love how you explain it, because it's about dilution, because what you've actually now done is you've taken your sauce, you've diluted it.
Yep. But and all you have to do is add this free ingredient that is actually already there, which is pasta water.
We're talking pasta with Douglas Williams, chef of Mida in Boston. We'll be back in a minute to take your pasta questions. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters, and we are talking to Douglas Williams. He's the chef of the restaurant Mida in Boston and an absolute pasta obsessive. We're taking your pasta cooking questions, and if you have questions for us on anything about food, turn on your voice memo app, record them, and send them to us at contact@splendidtable.org. Let's get back to Douglas. So, hey, let's go to our callers.
Sure.
And let's start with a pretty practical one. Let's start with Annie in Oregon.
Hi, I'm Annie. I'm calling from Salem, Oregon. I was wondering, what's the best way to store leftover pasta?
Oh, so storing leftover pasta. So I think that's a great, 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 great question. So
I love that that's your attitude towards it, because I think a lot of chefs would be like, oh, there's no such thing. Like, it's you eat it fresh and it dies.
Oh, no. I'm a leftover fiend. I need the leftovers sustain my life. And how do you think we make family meal? Like, that's that's one of the biggest ways. And also just cooking it in big batches. So there's two things to that. So when you say leftover pasta, I assume you mean one of two things. Kind of pasta that you cooked, that you pulled out, like I was explaining, and you put on a sheet pan, a little bit of oil, and it's undressed. And then there's pasta that you cooked with sauce that you have left over. I assume it's one of those two. So I'll just say the first thing. So first thing is, as I mentioned, you blanch it, slightly undercook it a little bit before it al dente. You add a little, you could toss it in a bowl, with a little bit of olive oil, toss, then lay on a sheet tray, or you can put it directly on a sheet tray, depending on the shape and the thickness and the fragility of it. And then get a kitchen towel, dampen it, squeeze it out, and lay it right on top. Let it come to, you know, somewhat room temperature. Wrap it in plastic, the whole thing with the towel on it, and then pop it in the fridge, and it'll hold for several days.
Oh, no kidding.
And it'll be just fine. Yeah, and it'll be awesome. If you have a little parchment paper or some sort of like wax paper, put that on the bottom before, if you're going to store it, put it between the sheet tray and the actual pasta. It'll just kind of, when metals contact with things for long periods of time, sometimes it can be a little weird, especially with egg and salt. So just put a little barrier between it, a little wax paper, parchment paper, or even worst case plastic wrap, just to create a separation between the, or Silpat, some silicone, if you have that.
Yeah.
Pop a little towel on top, wrap it up, and it'll hold for several days perfectly fine. And they won't stick together, which is even better.
It'll keep the texture when you reheat it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So that's also a way of pre-cooking pasta, which I've never heard anyone talk about.
Yes, especially if you're doing for 8, 10, 12, 20, if you're doing a pasta dinner, whatever it may be, and you don't want to cook all the pasta there, all you now need is your sauce, right? Because you already blanched it. All you need is this diluted sauce. Bring it up to a boil, add this pasta, toss around
and then just reheat it in the sauce.
And you're good, and you're reheated, but it also, it's very rare to have such big batch pasta cook perfectly, and that's how you can wow people, is by having this, because obviously it's cooked al dente, so it feels like you just cooked this all super fresh and so like a la minute, but actually you cooked this a day or two ago and you just brought it together and it was nothing for you because you already had it blanched.
That's amazing.
But you could just tell them you cooked it fresh and it'll be fine.
Yeah, that's incredible. What about like after you've had your dinner and you made a little bit extra?
Sure. So the biggest thing is heat, right? Heat is your biggest enemy when you're trying to essentially cool something down, because that's essentially what you want to do. You want to cool it down as soon as possible. So just, again, the sheet tray is your friend. If you only have a cookie tray with no edges, make sure you go out and just splurge on a cookie tray. They only cost about $15, and they'll last you forever, especially if they're professional quality. Look for the little NSF sign on the bottom and lay it out. Just lay it out flat, spread it with a little spatula, put it out as flat as humanly possible, and get it in the fridge right away. Clear some space, get it in the fridge, let it cool. And then once it's cool, now you can put it in any container you like, a Tupperware, or even leave it on that tray. But you just want to, the key is cool. You just want to get it as cold as possible, as quickly as possible, and you'll end up with a really great leftover product. Obviously, you can have less bandwidth to control the al dente, because essentially it's ready to go pasta that's meant to be eaten at that moment. So you will have to deal with that. But I mean, it'll,
then the microwave is your friend.
Yes. So the microwave. So another key with the reheat, I'm glad she asked that question, because the key with the reheat, most people don't know. So Mita, as of this past year, has done an incredible amount of business for to-go. And we do our mangia pasta, which is our all-you-can-eat pasta for obviously in-house, but also to-go. And a lot of people have, especially our guests, have wondered, how do you reheat pasta in a proper way? Obviously, it can be a lot with five pastas that you get with our mangia, to reheat them all in a pan. And then the microwave seems to not quite do the trick. So what you do actually is you do something in between. You take your microwave, you open it up, you put it on 2 minutes, you put it to 50% power. You take your little container of pasta, you add a little water to it, I'd say just a few ounces, shake it, give it a little shimmy, crack open the top just a bit, pop it in the microwave, and cook it. After that 2 minutes, you kind of go in, do a little discovery. Is it warm yet? Is it as hot as you want? No? Okay, put it on for another 2 minutes at 50% power. The 50% power makes meat, fish, very delicate items cook with this the same texture that you had it before.
It's just more gentle. Yeah. Oh, I love that.
It actually just reheats things in a much better way. And every time you do the 2 minutes, you give it a little shake, do another 2 minutes, give it a little shake, do another 2 minutes, and then it should be just fine. After about 2 to 4 minutes, it should be just where you want it, depending on how much you're heating up. But that's the move, is the 50% power.
I only just discovered that my microwave had a power double, because I just always go full blast. But that's great. That's great to know. All right, let's go to Sarah.
Hi, I'm Sarah, calling from Duluth, Minnesota, and we got a pasta maker for Christmas, and I recently found out that dried boxed pasta and fresh pasta are different in that the fresh pasta we've been making has eggs in it. But can you dry the fresh pasta that you make? Is that bad or food safe in any way? Thanks.
Oh, that's a great question, because I think a lot of people would be freaked out leaving the eggs out, but what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I really, honestly, in my opinion, if it's a home project and, you're feeding your children and you're feeding other people and you're not sure or you don't feel comfortable, there are some options. If you're making your own fresh pasta, it's not entirely necessary to dry it out. I actually love the texture of fresh pasta. I love how delicate it is. If you're trying to get it to more dried, it's not, you can't get anywhere close. It's just not possible because those come from extruders, which have very, very low ratios of liquid to flour. So no matter what you do, no matter how far you dry, it will either rot or it will just become so brittle that it won't even be able to be handled. So you're actually, it's just a losing game to try to get it to that level. So you can't really get there. But what you can do which I love doing and really makes, you know, especially when you're making a big batch of pasta, because obviously if you're making pasta at home, you're excited, you're pumped, everyone's stoked, and you really don't want to have to make it all that often unless you that is what you love to do. But if you want to make it once a month, what you do is you make a big batch, you say it's linguine or tagliatelle, you make it. You have it in these portions, right, of say, a big handful, and that's, say, one portion for you and for your family. And you basically put it on a tray, or you can wrap it in plastic, each portion separated, or put it in a little sandwich baggie. That's actually we do in the restaurant. We put them in little sandwich bags. We call them portion bags, and put them in the freezer. Put them in a bigger Tupperware.
Oh, right on.
Or a big freezer gallon bag, and just pop maybe five in for each freezer bag, and then pop them in the freezer, and they'll last indefinitely, and you won't have to worry about the egg, and you won't have to worry about drying and doing all these things. And drying takes space and equipment and time and a lot of energy, and it doesn't yield the results that you think it would. You just actually can't get it to that dryness. So I would say freezing, and honestly, the freezer does actually dry out a bit. It actually does dehydrate by about 10%, which actually is what you want. Is actually where we do the dryness that we take our pasta to. We take about 10% of moisture off of our pasta in order to give it a certain amount of chew and a certain amount of bite. We actually dry it overnight before we use it.
Oh, it actually changes the texture a little bit. It's not just preservation.
So, yes, but if you're going to dry it out in the refrigerator if you actually want it to be slightly drier and have a different texture, something more restaurant quality. But if you just want to go straight to freezer after portioning it, that is... It will last not only a month, it'll last 6 months, even further if you want. And it's ready on demand. You reach in this bag, you grab two portions out for you and your significant other, and you drop them in and you got pasta and you didn't even have to think about it. And you made it by hand, which is an incredibly great feeling.
Yeah, like you said, almost nothing in the kitchen is more satisfying than, you know, just mashing something together with your hands and all of a sudden having to be like, wow, this is like really nutritious and beautiful and delicious.
Yeah, especially when you can have it on demand whenever you like and show off and not have to do it all the time. But, you know, have to when you want to put that energy into it, great. And when you want to enjoy the, you know, the fruits of your labor and it feels organized and complete and safe and delicious, then there's really nothing better than that feeling.
Right on. Cool. Hey, let's go to Aspen, a person named Aspen.
Hi, I'm Aspen calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. And I'd like any advice getting a gluten-free pasta recipe or noodle recipe that doesn't suck. Thanks.
That's funny. As far as gluten-free is concerned, I honestly, in a lot of my interviews, I talk about how I have Crohn's disease. And how that really impacted my, you know, just everything about my life. But more so how it makes me alert to other people's conditions or aversions or allergies. And it set me on a path that when I created a restaurant and when I did a concept that it would be also very flexible, right? And you want to make sure you're amenable to people's feelings. Because the worst thing out of any dining experience is if you have a condition or you have something or you just have a general dislike of something, to ask the question of can you change this or can you do this is one of the worst feelings, especially when they make you feel bad about it. That's one of the things that I definitely wanted to not have be a thing at my restaurant, to make people feel bad about wanting to change or have to do something for their health. And make it just as fluid as ordering, you know, just a staple menu item. And that's how it should feel. So, you know, we offer our gluten-free pasta. At first, I tried to make it myself and put it through our machine. And then I was like, well, if we're putting it through our machine, then I can't get every bit of gluten out of this. And also, making gluten-free pasta is not simple. You can make it, but it doesn't hold together the same way. It's best, honestly, as extruded. Because extruded is... very low moisture and very high pressure. And when you combine those two things, you end up with this really, really similar, both in taste and texture, in cooking time to normal pasta. So if you are gluten-free, if your whole house is gluten-free and you don't have an extruder, which they actually make now, and I actually been seeing on the modern market, and they actually look really cool. If you have an extruder, then you can find gluten-free pasta recipes all over the place. But a lot of those are made for little extruders because it's really, it's not as great to make as fresh pasta. Although yeah. you could, but it doesn't quite come together because, again, there's no gluten. So if there's nothing to come through, the only thing that can really make it come together is pressure. And that's what an extruder does. So I would say invest in one of those or just buy. There's great gluten-free pasta that people make. I love a corn, quinoa, and rice flour mixture. Those are the three things that I look for. And then once you go from that, then, you know, that's how I kind of do it. But honestly, you have to undercook that pasta. And again, do the same thing. We do the same process in Mita. We blanch that pasta in clean water. We oil it lightly. And then we finish in sauce. And in that sauce. Is, again, the best way to do that. Because when you time it and cook the sauce at the same time and you pull it out and you just don't get it right, it ruins the whole batch. And when you're paying for gluten-free pasta, it's very expensive. It's almost triple the price. So you want to make sure that you're just focusing on that pasta, pre-cook it, have it ready, and then add it to your sauce when you're ready.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. Yeah, I'm actually amazed at how good box gluten-free pasta has gotten.
Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, well, again, a lot of people are making it fresh at first, but now they're extruding it and finding it just has that texture that's satisfying rather than be this, like, you know, trying to make a ravioli out of gluten-free pasta, which I actually haven't seen yet, which I would love to because I feel like you become a gajillionaire if you can figure out how to do that. So I'm still working on that.
Yeah. And for folks who don't know, an extruder is basically it's a high pressure machine that will push a dough through a die. So rather than, you know, mixing a dough like you would with fresh pasta and rolling it out with a rolling pin or even rolling it through those hand crank machines, this thing is very little water. The dough is extremely tough, extremely hard, but the machine can actually just push it right through a die and, you know, squeeze out tubes of spaghetti or whatever. So it is definitely something you can't do. It's entirely by machine. And like, you know, Douglas said, they are starting to make them for the home. They can be really expensive, but if you're really committed to making pasta at home, they're pretty cool to have.
Yes. You have a lot of flexibility with an extruder. You just have to do your research.
Right on. Well, thank you so much for all your time today, Chef. One of my best friends lives in Boston, and I can't wait to come eat at your restaurant one day.
Looking forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Douglas Williams, the chef of Mita in Boston, and he left us with a recipe. You guessed it, for bucatini on marinara. I swear he's just trolling me. You can find it at splendidtable.org, and you should feel free to make it with literally any other pasta shape. Yeah, I am just building my brand here. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Lily Kim, Alex Shafford, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer. The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper, and it's made every week by technical producer Jenny Lupke, associate producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.